Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 98. Poetry with Land and Lake, a conversation with Geraldine Green. Geraldine is a native of Ulverston, UK, and writer-in-residence at Swarthmore Hall. She has 5 poetry collections, The Skin, Paseo, The Other Side of the Bridge, Salt Road, and A Mole Catcher's Daughter, under the pseudonym Katie A. Coyle. Her work has been widely anthologized in poetry magazines in the UK, USA, and Italy, where she has read widely, including Dylan Thomas Center Swansea, Woody Fest Oklahoma, Walt Whitman Birthplace Long Island, Laurel Bookstore in California, International Women's Arts Festival, Kendall, Bowery Poetry Club, and more. Geraldine also has a poem in the All Book Books publication anthology of tribute to Walt Whitman called Primal Sanities. Geraldine obtained her PhD in creative writing in 2011. She has wide experience as a freelance creative writing tutor and mentor and has worked collaboratively with musicians, artists, and photographers. She's an associate editor of Poetry Bay, poetrybay.com, a publication from Long Island. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Welcome, Geraldine Green, to Between the Lines. How are you today?
Monk, yeah, I'm absolutely fine. We spent a wonderful day swimming at Sunken Meadow. Jeff and I have just been really, really enjoying the hospitality and warmth of our friends on Long Island. That includes yourself, of course.
Oh, well, thanks.
Thank you.
Now, Jeff's your husband. He's from Liverpool, right?
He is, absolutely, yes. Scouser born and bred, and he's cooking some kind of wonderful garlicky brown rice thing at the minute. So he's in the kitchen, so you shouldn't hear any noise.
Okay.
But, yeah, he's from Liverpool, and I'm from Cumbria.
That's how I was going to say Cumbria, but I was going to let you pronounce it correctly.
So. Okay, it's Cumbria, but people tend to know it as the Lake District, and I guess it's the association with the poets, William Wordsworth,
yeah.
Coleridge, Shelley, the Romantic poets, but it's actually Cumbria. It's a big county.
So is the Lake District, is that part of Cumbria, or is that, is kind of separate?
No, it's absolutely the heart of it. It's a Lake District National Park.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it is a national park within the boundaries of a bigger county called Cumbria.
Oh, okay.
However, Cumbria in 1974 That's when it came into existence. Before 1974, it used to be Cumberland, Westmorland, and Lancashire, north of the Sands. And the Sands are the Sands of Morecambe Bay, which is a huge area of mudflat, very important site for wading birds, for migrating birds. But in 1974, it ceased to be these three different shire counties and became Cumbria. And the Lake District National Park, it's a little park of mountains and fells and, you know, lakes, obviously, within the greater county of Cumbria.
Okay. Now,
that's the scene, I think.
We'll get to your poetry. I know that the way you describe the area, it must steep instill your poetry, because your poetry is very lush and lyrical.
Thank
and
you.
Very rooted with the nature. Yeah, first that area. Now, that's because I haven't read him in so long, but Wordsworth was my favorite poet in college, and I remember writing some essay that was due on, I think it was Tintern Abbey or something like that.
Yeah, that's Somerset. But Wordsworth was from Cockermouth, which is near where Jeff and I used to live, near Keswick in North Cumbria. And he, yeah, like me, he was inspired by the beauty and of not just the land, but the integrity and the sense of place of the people who live and still inhabit the land.
Now, can you, like, what's your, because I know you're like a real tuned in type of person, and you, like, when you're out walking and doing stuff, do you feel that energy? Do you tune into it? What's your experience?
I think it's a mixture. I mean, for me, especially with the latest collection, Salt Road, it's been a surprise to me moving back from, well, first of all, the Wirral, where Jeff and I lived, which is near Liverpool, and then we moved back to Cumbria, but we moved back to Keswick, which is very much the heart of the Romantic poets. But then 4 years ago, we moved back down to the southwest Cumbria, which is the Furness Peninsula. It's very peaceful, it's very quiet, it's steeped in history and, I think, a sense of the sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was, I had no plans to write a new collection,
mm-hmm.
but the first poem I wrote when I was down there was inspired by a walk out onto the sands of Morecambe Bay called Salt Road into the Bay. I was walking with my dog, Roy, a border collie, a spirited place and a loyal friend. And as I do, I actually talk to the dog, as you do. And I was saying, you know, you can, I'm walking the salt road into the bay. And then the poem grew out of that. And then we walked on a birk rig, which is, it's birk is birches and rig is ridge.
Mm.
So it's the ridge of the silver birches. And it's called Berkeley Common. And I was actually walking with my dog Roy. And I said, you know, you can sit on any of these limestone outcrops. You can watch butterflies land on harebells, alpine lady slippers or torment hill, and listen to the wind shushing bracken. And then I thought, wow, I think I've got a poem written on.
Yeah, I thought to say.
Yeah. I kind of like went home very quickly and, I wrote a poem called Limestone Outcrop, Berkeley. So, yeah, it's very much a sense of place, but a sense of the people who inhabit the place, and also the non-humans, in particular the, I think for me, the wading birds, the seabirds, the migrating birds, because it's a symbol of what humans do, what humans are like. We migrate back and forth. You know, where do we belong, you know, to have that sense of place or nationality? It's a little bit edgy, a little bit tricky, this one. For me, we're a little bit like the migrating birds, the caribou, the salmon. We come and go, we find a place, we feel rooted and are very blessed to be rooted there. But I feel that if we respect the sacredness of where we each feel a sense of belonging, my hope is that maybe we won't trash everybody else's sense of sacredness.
Yeah,
sense of place.
That's real important, and we both have a, you know, an affinity for Aboriginal ways.
Yes,
and you reminded me of a friend who put a little book together, the word peregrinations, because that,
yes,
you know, the root of the peregrine falcon,
the
and
falcon,
also traveling.
That's
so,
right.
And I've heard Native people call it, the along with the feathered ones or the winged ones, the birds are the other two-leggeds, because we have two legs and
yes,
they have two legs, so there's a lot going on there. Now, I want to get, there's a poem you read the other night, it's I am, something about I am a birch, and
yeah,
that's flush. Before we get to that, because
yes,
I want that to kind of balance out. Now, a little while ago I had seen an article, I think I sent it to you, about some kind of contamination on the shore. It was one in, is that in the Lake District near you? It was something, was it nuclear or something?
Oh, there's a nuclear power plant.
Oh, yeah.
Sellafield.
Yeah, so what, say a little bit about that before you read the poem. Just to show what, you know, the kind of thing that you write about, it
yeah,
is in part to, you know, maybe not directly, but I know you're guided by that sense of, you know, preserving that kind of the beauty.
Well, yeah, funnily enough, I do have a poem called Power Lines, which isn't in front of me, but which is in my latest collection called Salt Road, and it's called Power Lines, and it actually addresses the fact that West Cumbria is called the Energy Coast. Now, that's, you know, it sounds, oh, how wonderful. However, the sting in the tail is the fact that in West Cumbria, you've got a place called Eskmeels, which still is. It's a gun testing range that fires guns out into the Irish Sea. Now that actually was from the Second World War. Then you've got Windscale, which became Sellafield, and now it's BNFL, British Nuclear Fuel. So it kind of keeps changing its name. And it's on the edge of the Lake District National Park. No way that nuclear reprocessing plant would be allowed in the national park.
No.
So the irony is, for me, West Cumbria is probably the most beautiful part of Cumbria. People go to Grasmere, Ambleside, Windermere, Keswick. For me, the wildness of West Cumbria on the Irish Sea, and then you've got this juxtaposition of this nuclear plant, and it's just an anathema to me. And so I used to be quite active when I was younger and lived, in Cumbria, born and bred. And with CND, which is Campaign Against Nuclear Disarmament, but also CORE, which was Cumbrians Opposed to Radioactive Energy. And I'm still very strongly against the nuclear power industry because people say, oh, yes, it's cheap, it's clean. And, of course, no, it's not, because you've got jets fly over to patrol the safety of the plant. You've got British Nuclear Fuel has its own police that are not answerable to anybody, not the police, but to the state. Very frightening, actually. And yet, the nuclear plant lies between the beauty of the Irish Sea, looking across to the Isle of Man, beyond that, the mountains of Mourne in Ireland, and then the West Cumbrian coast with the Scawfell Range, which is the highest mountain range in England. And you've got this mushrooming, horrible nuclear plant.
Yeah, one word to have for people about nuclear is Fukushima. That's the one word.
Absolutely.
It's like a strange combo. It's reminded me, I lived in Colorado for some years a while ago, and, you know, there's beautiful mountains, and then, you know, after I got there, I learned that NORAD, I forgot what it stands for, it's like the plane tracking system for the U.S. or whatever, that the NORAD is the radar or whatever, it's literally built inside the mountain.
it's
a strange thing.
Very grotesque about that, and it's dishonorable. It doesn't respect the spirit of place, the sense of sacredness, which I think you and I resonates very strongly with. That sense of place, the sense of sacredness, of honouring the land, reverencing the land and the language and the indigenous people who live and inhabit that particular particular piece of land.
Yeah, your poem. So I want to hear your poem. I forgot the title you told me about. Because that's the one of them that stood out when I heard you read aloud.
Oh, thank you. I actually really, when I read that, I feel like, I know it sounds a bit corny, and I apologize.
No, that's all right.
But when I read that, I feel like it resonates somewhere in me that takes on a deeper tone. Hmm. I don't know, it's an odd feeling, and every time I've read it at different venues, whether here in the States or in the UK, I kind of enter that different, kind of zone of feeling. It's an odd thing. But the poem's called All Day I Sit in the Woods. And the title grew out of a line from a poem called Jacklight by an indigenous Native American Indian poet called Louise Erdrich.
Oh, yeah. I think she has a book that just won, the novel won a big prize.
Oh, really?
Something.
Fabulous poet.
Yeah, I think, yeah, anyway.
And the line was, we have come to the edge of the woods. And because I actually do sit in woods with my back against a tree that feels comfortable and steady, and it's a form of meditation, but it's a kind of loose meditation. I wouldn't call it, it's not a practicing meditation, but I just sit and let go.
Yeah.
It's called All Day I Sit in the Woods. All day and all night I sit, my hair on fire with the wind. All day I sit and sing. All day I sit, my back against this pine. My breathing slows, becomes sap that oozes up and down the tree's spine. All day I sit and sing, my back to the wind. All day and all night, the flashlight's green as northern lights. All night I and the pines weave a song from alders and willows that live below the horizon. All day I claw my mind to the top of the woods. My hands somersault over and under, become a tapestry of limbs. I and the wind and the pines discover each other again, discover the smell of men, their cigarette breath, their unhinged shotgun fingers, triggered, crooked. All day I sit and weave the wind, my hair becomes grey lichen, I hang from branches. My name now is no name, my body is white and silver, my name is birch and alder, my tongue the sound of finches, my feet sown deep into earth. All day I grow deeper.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, one of the things I love about your poetry is it's not only the language and the imagery, but it has that literally lyrical. It flows like a song, you know, you're like a songbird yourself singing. So I find that lacking in a lot of modern poetry is that I feel like it's lost some of the song quality. So I'm a big fan when I hear the words carry, have a rhythm.
The music.
I think the music and sometimes repetition, that refrain helps to do that. Before I forget, where can people, you mentioned your new book, Salt Road, where can people find that? You have a blog?
I do, actually. If people want to key in Geraldine Green, Salt Road blog, they'll find lots of information about me, my poetry, my workshops, the readings I give, and the workshops, you know, venues, etc. But the publishers are Indigo Dreams. That's Indigo Dreams.
Okay.
So if anybody would like to key in Geraldine Green, Salt Road, Indigo Dreams, you'll find the last two collections, whether it's Salt Road or the previous one, which was called The Other Side of the Bridge, which you were very kind enough to review.
Oh, yeah.
I appreciate that.
I have that. I have a few lines that I wanted to quote
because
they're so neat. You have one poem that I quoted in the review was, I go to my dressing table, pick up the earrings bought in New Mexico, wonder whose hand hit the copper seam that made them. It's just a simple, it's like almost, almost unpoetic, but it's poetic because it's it just touches into respecting, you know, where something comes from and,
absolutely,
and how you tune in to people really well. And another one you're describing, Uncle Owen. Uncle Owen,
Uncle Owen
is in the back kitchen. Well, you can do it better than I can. Playing sax. You want to read that?
Do you know what? I don't have that one.
Oh, well, I'll read that.
Can you believe it?
The line is, in the back kitchen playing his saxophone, him with a grin as wide as a 10-pin bowling alley.
That was Uncle Owen. I mean, believe me, that was Uncle Owen.
That was what?
That was Uncle Owen.
Oh, Uncle Owen.
He just was like that.
Yeah.
He was,
so I thought that line's great. They're just the rhythm of him with a grin as wide as a
10-pin bowling alley.
The rhythm is great, and then the image is real whammo.
Well, there's a couple of poems. I don't know. There's a long poem called, not that I'm going to read it, so don't worry, Poem of a Mole Catcher's Daughter. And it was based on stories told by my mum and my grandparents and another uncle called Ozzy, which is Oswald. I wouldn't mind reading a little extract of that, if I may.
Oh, sure.
Would that be okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
And this is based on a real character called Sal Madge, that my mum told me about. I'll just read the poem, or extract of the poem.
Okay.
Poem of a Mole Catcher's Daughter. If I stand here long enough, if I stand on this cliff, listening to the wind, what will I hear? Sal Madge lived down Rosemary's Lonning. Sal Madge was a gypo. Sal Madge was dirty. Sal Madge, Sal Madge, are you still there with your pipe and your spitting and your singing ditties, your brat full of coal gathered from the beach down by Whitehaven docks? If I stand watching ghosts from my bed, will I see Sal Madge a wanderer? Sal Madge a man with her pipe and her spitting? Sal Madge, kids would shout after her. Sal Madge never minded them kids yelling, she loved them, cuffed them, collected bird shells and eggs for them. Sal Madge was brave, gathering eggs from nests on the cliffs at St. Bees. If I stand here watching ghosts drift among sea pinks and thrifts, who will I see? Sal Madge, born in a coracle in Ireland. Sal Madge playing a fiddle. Sal Madge wearing odd shoes. Sal Madge lived in a hovel down Rosemary's Lonning, scared of no one, not even the ghost of old McAlinden. Sal Madge smoked a pipe, wore men's clothes, was a gypsy. Sal Madge was a man. Sal Madge was lonely.
Yeah, that's nice, really nice. Great. Almost makes me want to stop, write a poem about somebody. Now that reminded me of, you wrote, I was amazed, maybe it was one of the first times we met, I'm not sure, but you came to Long Island and you hadn't been here before, I think, and you wrote a poem about Walt Whitman, which got into the anthology I published, Primal Sanities.
Oh,
yes. You have that poem?
I do, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, I'm just going to wander upstairs here. I'm walking upstairs with me with a telephone in my hand.
You had mentioned before Jeff is in the kitchen cooking. When I interviewed David Amram a while ago,
yeah,
after like 15 minutes, I heard this loud banging and noises in the background, so I jumped in and I said, so maybe you can tell us what's going on. And he's like, I'm in the kitchen making some tea.
Bless. That's David for you.
But it was so, I loved it because it was like that,
well,
you know,
it's
like that beat.
It?
But it's also that flow. It's like that artistic flow that, you know, he's of the beat generation.
Yeah.
And that's part of, you know, that it's not, things aren't so official. Like, you know, when we first
Absolutely.
Got on, you're talking about what's in the moment. And
yes,
I think
that's very important.
It takes that kind of tuned inness to write the poem like that you wrote when you got to Long Island. And I mean, there's some people that on Long Island that perhaps, you know, didn't even tune in. You know, they tune in their own way, but you just got a certain quality of Whitman that is really nice. So go ahead and read that one.
Oh, Walt. And just before I read it, I have to just backtrack a little bit.
Uh-huh.
It has, talking about David Amram. It's been a great honour and a pleasure to read alongside such a wonderful worldwide musician.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Oh, my God. I mean, at the Woody Guthrie Festival, on a number of occasions, he backs the poets, including me, and I'm like, pinch myself. You know, it's David Amram, and he's playing. Which, so that was a little thank you to David. The poem is called Walt. Okay?
All right.
Walt, you with your jaunty stance, your hat on one side, a wide-brimmed smile blowing you over the Hempsteads. You with your blackthorn stick and your stride, your billowing voice lamenting the parting of seabirds. You with your arms like happy windmills, waving to the sea, the land, the railroads, and soldiers. You with your laughing beard, baring your chest as you make your way around the boundaries of oceans. You, Walt Whitman, of the long line and tumbling somersaults of tender poetry, with your working man's hands and your mystery, and the digging of graves and gardens in the planting of trees here on your beloved fish-tailed island. Buried deep in your heart of lobsters and clams, the King James Bible walks with each step you make as you mark the bounds, smiling as you see someone you resemble. A woman cradling a child, an old man, a prophet, a wanderer, a hobo. You, Walt, pray to the sea and the air as I do, bending your knees to better understand the blades of grass.
Lovely. That's that's really nice, and it segues perfectly. You sent me some quotes that you have, because you're the writer-in-residence at Swarthmore Hall in, I'll try to pronounce it right, Ulverston?
Yeah, that's perfect. Well done. Ulverston.
Ulverston, that's, yeah. I'm getting the contact language high here. But you can say a little bit about the place, but first the quote. I tend to think of poetry as a form of compost, recycled energy, that we create something out of nothing and give it back to the universe in a poem or in a prayer, or perhaps poems are prayers.
Mm-hmm.
That's really nice.
Thank you. That really was something that's close to my heart and the center of the, hopefully, my poems and prose and why I write poetry and part of the fabric of who I am, I hope. I mean, not always, because we're not perfect, but it's a kind of a mantra that carries me through life on the journey. But Swarthmore Hall it's the birthplace of Quakerism. It's where Judge Thomas Fell and his wife Margaret Fell lived. It dates back to the 1600s. It's a wonderfully tranquil place to look around, and it's literally about a 5-minute walk from where Jeff, my husband, and I live. So it's very special to be so close. And out of the blue, I thought I'd love to be a writer in residence there. It was such a key part of where I played, where I grew up, in the fields, in the Beck. Springfield, which is all the land that's owned by the Quakers, part of the Swarthmore Hall land. And when we moved back to Ulverston, I thought, I think I'll just, you know, I'm exploring the sense of the sacred. For me, the Furness Peninsula is very much has a deep-rooted sense of the sacred. So I actually wrote to the Jane Pearson at the Hall and explained my feelings of why I would like to have been writer in residence, exploring, you know, our poems, prayers, etc. But Swarthmore Hall is, as I said, the birthplace of Quakerism. Judge Thomas Fell was very instrumental in the area as the key kind of, I suppose, you know, big guy, the big shot. He was the judge. He would cross the bay, across the sands and the quicksands to Lancaster. And that's where he would hold the assizes. And his wife, Margaret Fell, met George Fox, who was an itinerant preacher from Leicester and had a vision to go north. And the north was Lancashire. And he ended up in Ulverston. And he converted, this is a very brief history, but he converted Margaret Fell, her servants, her family, to the ethos and spirit of Quakerism.
Now, because Walt Whitman, I think his mom was a Quaker, so did that came over to the U.S. Turtle Island?
Yes, it did. And in fact, William Penn, who probably know from Pennsylvania.
Right.
William Penn and George Fox are very close friends. And George Fox traveled to Long Island. He preached at Flushing. He preached at Oyster Bay. He preached at Shelter Island. And he drew crowds of thousands because he was like, yes, God, or the light, or the spirit, or the sacred, whatever name you want to give to it, is in everybody. And he wanted to meet the indigenous people of New England, Connecticut, Long Island. And he met them, and he felt their spirit, their grace, and their sense of the sacred.
Yeah, that's lovely.
For me, I didn't know when I actually was appointed writer in residence at Swarthmore Hall. I didn't realise that George Fox came to Long Island to preach. So for me, that was an eye opener. It's like a wow! I go to Long Island.
Yeah, all the connecting.
Wow! Yeah, exactly. All that synchronicity and connections. So that's how it kind of it organically grew out of my wanting to explore the sense of place and the spirit of place on and around the Furness Peninsula. So it's amazing how travels connect, stories connect.
Yeah, sometimes you just like going somewhere is not really going that far.
Exactly. You've kind of got to trust that alignment of of travel. There's some kind of energy alignment, and if you trust that and follow your heart and intuition, yeah. Trust that and go with it.
Yeah, that's a good thing for people to know.
Thank you.
I saw on something you sent me you're doing, maybe that's at Swarthmore, four workshops that are, or maybe you already did them, that are connected with the seasons.
Yes.
Now that's really neat, because that certainly appreciate that from my haiku sensibility, which goes by the seasons. But say a little bit about that. Like, you have one that's called A Wing and a Prayer, symbolism of spring, new breath, new life. And then summer, you call it fire in the tongue.
Mm.
And autumn, touch the earth. And winter, healing well. Time of snow and fog and ice. So it's your descriptions are poetic, too. So, yeah, say a little bit.
Oh, thank you. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, when Jane Pearson, who's the director and administrator at Swarthmore Hall, when she got my email saying, hello, I'd like to be writer in residence at Swarthmore Hall, we actually got together and she said, okay, let's discuss this. So we did, and a few things evolved from that, one of which was these series of four workshops that you've just described. I've held two of them, the spring, the Wing and a Prayer, and Fire in the Tongue, that was in June. The next one's in September, which is Touch the Earth. And I actually got the title for Touch the Earth from a book edited by T.C. McLuhan, called Touch the Earth. And it's a collection of stories by Indigenous American Indians about what it was like where they lived, and then when the white men came and destroyed their whole culture, the land, and their rootedness. And so Touch the Earth is in September. It'll be celebrating, obviously, the fruits of the earth. But symbolically, it's kind of a gathering together of thoughts and ideas, a garnering of fruits, of the seeds for the next lot of poems and prose pieces that people who have been on the workshops will be producing for an anthology, which will be celebrating next June. It's the Midsummer Festival of Poetry at Swarthmore Hall. There'll be music and poetry, and there'll be an anthology called A Wing and a Prayer.
Oh, nice.
With work by people who've been on the workshops. And as you said, the winter one is water. And it's interesting when I was looking at the actual seasons and what they physically represent, and then looking at the mythology and then Celtic mythology and ancient Greek mythology on the symbolism of the seasons, and I was like, I wouldn't have thought water was winter, but in the Celtic wheel, it is. I'm like, okay, right, fog, frost, ice, snow, and then the melting of it, and then it becoming spring, and then the breath of migrating birds back, and new life. So that's how it kind of evolved as I structured the series of four, which are the cardinal points north, south, east, and west, and obviously the circle of life.
Yeah,
and the center points, which is very American Indian, I think.
Yeah, again, you're touching the indigenous people that are still. Yeah. Yeah, of course, even though a lot of the culture was destroyed, their culture is so deep that
absolutely.
it's still you know, it's, I think we're in this age of where there's a resurgence. So
absolutely,
and that, you know, any place anywhere on the planet where there's so much going on, anybody that's tuning into that, I think, is a help. You know, to help all the energies of the planet, of the Mother Earth.
I think as well, I think you're right, Mark, because when I said about it destroyed, it didn't, obviously, because that energy and spirit is so strong in each of us, I believe, and in different cultures around the world, that ultimately, for me, the energy is love.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, L-O-V-E,
right,
word that people sometimes feel a little bit uneasy with,
mm-hmm.
but it's at the heart of the Sufi, I wouldn't call it religion, the Sufi religion, but the Sufi sense of the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
It's love. It's what Rumi spoke about, and Hafiz, Ibn al-Arabi. It's this sense of connecting. It's unconditional love. It's getting rid of the ego, lighting these sparks like fireflies. And hopefully, there'll be enough fireflies, enough sparks to reignite a sense of compassion and love, sincerity and wisdom that we feel, perhaps we feel, has been lost in a world that's suddenly full of greed and hate and fear. No, let's celebrate. Let's bring joy back to our hearts.
That's beautiful.
Cute.
Also, I think some of the what happens when that starts happening is, I was looking at one of your blogs and you have a line, "So precious this spirit of joy, especially the laughing."
Oh, yeah.
So that's true, too, I think, you know, when, you know, when the laughing kind of breaks through the breaks through stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was from a workshop I ran in Newcastle, and somebody posted saying, "Oh, I really enjoyed the workshop, especially the laughing." I was like, wow, that's brilliant. I love that little phrase.
That is neat.
Brilliant. So, you know, maybe that's a good place to end and say, let's enjoy, let's celebrate, especially the laughing, the great laugh of Buddha.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, and if you want to, we can wrap it up there if you like.
Does that sound okay, or would you like me to finish on a poem?
That's,
I'm quite happy with whatever you...
Maybe read one more poem.
Okay, I've just...
Yeah, why don't we wrap up with one more poem.
Okay. I've just opened my folder that I'm going to be taking with me to the Catskills for a couple of gigs there at the Bright Hill Centre at Treadwell, and then Poets in the Park and the Robert Burns statue in Albany. I just opened up the folder and I've got actually Salt Road into the Bay, which is the poem, the very first poem I wrote that was grew into my latest collection, Salt Road. So maybe that's a kind of apposite moment to I could read the poem and we could put it up there.
Sure.
It's called Salt Road into the Bay. It's late afternoon, and I walk alongside the mud flats of Morecambe Bay. The bay, the flats, the tide that swings its way in and out. Different, different. I walk out into wind, salt, and flat caked mud, baked white in the sun, and I tread among samphire, spiked as yet unplumped shoots of bright green, small pockets of prayer, parcels of ozone, and ask, are you really samphire, that bright jewel of Shakespeare, picked, plucked, remembered from Lear? And it's into the salt and the sea, and into the tide and the flats. I follow footprints, trainers, nobbled patterns in salt, horses' hooves, branding sky into flesh, salt into sand, me into them, us into us all. A caterpillar tyre, a shrimper's tractor, curving round and out. I curve like that, eating samphire, as if I'm its juice, as if I'm its flesh, as if I'm crushed into samphire green. I pause, take breath, and take in the sweep and sway before the next wash of tide in the Irish Sea.
Very beautiful, lush. Like I said, lush and lyrical.
Oh, thank you.
not to label you, but those are the words.
Lush and lyrical.
Lush and lyrical, those are the
words
that come to mind.
The first poet who had influence on me was Dylan Thomas.
Oh, yeah. That's how the song.
Fern Hill is just a poem I just love.
Okay.
So that's a sense of the lyrical that
yeah.
resonates. And I agree with you. I think that's been lost in a bit of harsh edginess and dark, depressive stuff. And it's like, let's get back to the music. Celebrate. Especially the laughing.
That's nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, Monk, thank you very, very
Thanks
much.
Thanks so much, Geraldine. I know you you teach some writing workshops,
I do,
and I can tell just from talking to you here that I learned a lot. And,
thank you.
So I wish you good luck and have fun with your travels and enjoy your dinner with Jeff and whoever.
Yeah. Monk, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Peace. Blessings.
And to you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
And we'll go out with a poem, thanks to the miracle of YouTube, read by Dylan Thomas, his poem Fern Hill.
Now as I was young and easy under the apple boughs about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb, golden in the heydays of his eyes. And honored among wagons, I was prince of the apple towns. And once below a time, I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns about the happy yard, and singing as the farm was home, in the sun that is young once only. Time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means. And green and golden I was huntsman and herdsman. The calves sang to my horn. The foxes on the hills barked clear and cold. And the Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams. All the sun long it was running, it was lovely, the hay fields high as the house, the tunes from the chimneys. It was air and playing, lovely and watery, and fire green as grass. And nightly under the simple stars, as I rode to sleep, the owls were bearing the farm away. All the moon long I heard, blessed among stables, the night jars flying with the ricks, and the horses flashing into the dark. And then to awake, and the farm like a wanderer white with the dew, come back, the cock on his shoulder. It was all shining, it was Adam and maiden, the sky gathered again, and the sun grew round that very day. So it must have been after the birth of the simple light in the first spinning place, the spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable onto the fields of praise. And honored among foxes and pheasants by the gay house, under the new-made clouds, and happy as the heart was long, in the sun born over and over, I ran my heedless ways. My wishes raced through the house high hay, and nothing I cared at my sky-blue trades that time allows, in all his tuneful turning, so few and such morning songs, before the children green and golden follow him out of grace. Nothing I cared in the lamb-white days that time would take me up to the swallow-thronged loft by the shadow of my hand in the moon that is always rising. Nor that riding to sleep, I should hear him fly with the high fields, and wake to the farm forever fled from the childless land. Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea.